Hello, my name's John Matheson. I'm a cinematographer on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Well, hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey there, sexy. How's it going?
Hey, going pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing awesome. Hey. I'm liking our new plan of doing this in the morning, by the way. I feel like I feel a whole lot less wanting to go to sleep the whole time. So,
yeah, that there's something nice about, doing this while the sun is still out.
It's true. And, it's like part of our work day, and it's like, we're doing a job. But moreover, I would always do it after my son went to bed. And for those parents out there, bedtime is it's a marathon. And then it was like, okay, now I got to go do host wraps, which I love doing because I love talking to you. But holy crap, doing it in the morning is so much better.
It is better. Absolutely. So, hey, Ben, who is on the show today?
Well, John Matheson, cinematographer of Gladiator 2 and also Gladiator.
That's right. Gladiator and Gladiator 2.
And which I actually just saw Gladiator 2. You conducted this interview, but mm-hmm. I just saw Gladiator 2 a couple of days ago. And let me say, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really cool. And it's part of the, what are they calling it? Glicked Wadiator? Was it? It's the Wicked Gladiator double team. And we do have, by the way, for anyone interested, an interview coming up with Alice Brooks, DP of Wicked, which to me is just an amazing film as well. So, but yeah.
I can't wait to see it. Yeah,
Gladiator is crazy pants. I went to see it kind of expecting more or less a retread of the first one, and I had no idea how bonkers it was going to be. And also, like, Denzel Washington just walks away with this entire movie. He's so great.
I got to see the movie at Paramount during a sort of like first sort of press public tour sort of thing. It was the first West Coast premiere of Gladiator, and they had Denzel there and other members of the cast, and they did a Q&A afterwards, which was really cool. So it was an excellent experience.
Yeah, I just saw it at a movie theater like a commoner. Like, just got a ticket and went to see it.
Well, I will tell you, it was interesting to me seeing it in that environment. First of all, the Paramount screening room is bonkers. Talk about bonkers. That place is always like super calibrated, incredible seats. It's like it's a fantastic place to see a movie. That being said, when I left there, I didn't necessarily get the opinion that from talking to other people that this movie was going to set the world on fire, and it totally is. So that's really impressive. It's really,
well, I mean, I think that there were probably for a lot of us were a lot of questions like, why is it taking 24 years to make a sequel to a movie that won Best Picture and was a huge hit?
Yeah, they had costumes and all kinds of stuff. It was definitely designed to impress the press, and it did. It was a very impressive spectacle. So, before we get to the interview with John Matheson,
and now Closed Focus.
What do we have to talk about today? What is going on in the world of entertainment?
Well, I mean, it's kind of timely because, yeah, we have the Glicked weekend. Norm MacDonald always had a joke about the abbreviation for identification being ID, and I stands for I and D stands for identification.
That's right.
Yes. How it's really doing a lot of the heavy lifting in that abbreviation. And I feel like, with Barbenheimer last year, we definitely had, like, there was relative parity, although Barbie did way better than Oppenheimer. But in this case, Wicked's just blowing everybody away. And so both, but I guess what it is it's like two counter-programmed tentpoles opening on the same weekend and both finding a kind of an enormous audience, although clearly Wicked is hitting just one of the biggest audience probably since Barbie. I mean, it's a huge hit.
162 million worldwide. Yeah, that's amazing. That's super impressive. And there was a whole
congratulations
list
to Alice Brooks, who again I think will be on the podcast next week. We've already done the interview, but congrats to Alice Brooks for shooting an amazing film.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of other firsts. There's a list on this Deadline article of all the sort of like biggest opening biggest opening weekend ever for particular actors, for a pop star,
for Ariana Grande. And I'm like, What was the second biggest opening for Ariana Grande? I actually couldn't answer that question. I couldn't tell you what else she's been in movie wise.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's
she's great in it.
It's breaking all the records, and it's only part one. There's going to be a part two. So,
oh my God, yeah, and it's like only 15 minutes shorter than the whole play if you went to see the whole play, and I believe that includes the intermission. Wow. But I will say this about it: it's never boring. It doesn't feel padded. You know,
like
any movie, could you cut something out of it? Yeah, probably. But it's pretty solidly. It's like wall to wall. Pretty. Anyone who knows me knows, like, you know, I'm a theater guy, but I'm not a musical theater guy per se. And I've never seen the stage play Wicked. And so, you know, I kind of went in like, you know, I mean, like when we interviewed Alice last time for In the Heights, you know. Not really my genre, but I could see the amazing artistry that went into it, and I got, you know, certainly caught up in it. I was really taken in with it, and it's really emotional and surprising in certain ways. Alice in our interview will talk about that, but that's for a later episode. But but then also, you know, the same weekend we had Gladiator 2 kind of, you know, clocking in what would be considered a pretty solid opening weekend, even if it was the only big movie opening that weekend.
Yeah, there was a little bit of conversation about trying to get some big movies out before Moana. They expect Moana 2 to just, you know, blow up at the box office, but Gladiator 2 and Wicked, I mean these are really, really strong numbers, and Gladiator 2 definitely had a really, really strong turnout. I have to look to see what the latest total was, but I think it was like 60 million or something like that domestically. It was like, it was really solid.
It was a pretty solid thing. And, you know, and again, I saw it. I mean, I think that they're both really good movies. I'm interested for Moana too. Like, the thing about Wicked is, you know, like my thought was, could I take my 6-year-old to see it? And then I saw it and I'm like, he'd be into this movie, except it's like an hour longer than his attention span, but that could just be him.
You weren't taking him to Gladiator 2. So
not Gladiator 2. Definitely Wicked, but like Moana, you know, Moana will be like dialed in for little kids, and we haven't really had that I know of, like a family film, like a kids film, since The Wild Robot, which wasn't that long ago. But, you know, when you have a kid, it starts to feel like a desert of entertainment choices, because, you know, it's like once every 4 months something comes out that you could take your kids to.
You know, I just want to kind of point out, because there's an awful lot of press that's been going on lately about the death of television, the death of movies, and that people are spending time on social media. Every time there is a Glicked, just like this weekend just happened, I feel like, you know, it's a bunch of people hopping on the bandwagon of what's great to talk about right now, but not really paying attention to the reality, because clearly people want to go see it in the theater. And that's amazing. And I'm really, really glad.
Well, I think these are two good examples of movies in some really awesome ways, and also some ways that I'm not like down on it, but like, I wish that it didn't have to be IP. I wish that people would want to go see a movie. I mean, you know, but honestly, Oppenheimer wasn't IP. You know, Oppenheimer is a biopic that could be like bone dry in the wrong hands, could be a total flop or made for television and nobody gives a shit. And yet it was a massive hit. But, you know, like, these are movies that use the big screen really well, that are directed by masters of their craft and shot by masters of their craft, with phenomenal actors in it, phenomenal spectacle, and stuff that you just don't see every day. And I think that it kind of reminds us why we want to go see movies in the theater. And, you know, and Wicked is an interesting case study, because, like, it even mentions it in this Deadline article that, you know, like, there have been some serious flops from Broadway musicals, probably most notably Cats. And it's like, you know, I have a way. Here's how you could have made Cats a hit. Do what they do when they just film a live Broadway show, like they did with Hamilton, and put it on Disney Plus. Do that and show it in theaters, and people will accept a really good production of Cats. You don't need to turn it into a weird ass CGI movie. But Wicked is a different situation, in that I feel like Wicked has, you know, like I said, is kind of living in three narrative traditions: books, movies, and theater, and musical theater specifically. But even the original movie was musical, and so it's got to, like, it has to like hit all these things. And and when you watch it, I won't say they do it effortlessly. They do it effortfully, but so well. Like, it doesn't stink of effort. It stinks of like spectacle. It's what you want. And it's also what you want out of something like Gladiator, where, you know, if you've ever wanted to see a bunch of people fighting in the Colosseum in boats and there are sharks swimming around them, I've never seen that. I did spend a lot of the movie worrying about the sharks, how they got the sharks there, what happened to the sharks afterwards, that kind of stuff. But
How about the horrific, gigantic primate monkey type of creatures?
Yeah. The monkeys, the rhinos. I mean, there are a lot of CGI animals. You know, actually, I'll say the one head scratcher for me in the whole movie was that one of the main characters has a dog, and the dog is clearly CGI. I'm like, couldn't get a dog? Just get a dog.
Hey, well, Ben, I think we should get to the interview with John Matheson.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by cinematographer John Matheson. Hey, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you.
Hey, you got your start, at least to my knowledge, shooting a lot of music videos for some of the biggest artists of the time, U2, Nirvana, Prince, just to name a few. But you didn't really come on my radar as a cinematographer. Like, even though I was familiar with all those music videos, I wasn't aware of the person behind the visuals until Gladiator. Gladiator was this monumental movie in the, you know, in the early 2000s, 2000, 2001, that like, it was a major, major tentpole impact movie. Did that movie also have an impact on, what did that do to your life? What was the original Gladiator? How did that, what did that do to your career?
Well, as you said yourself, I mean, I was doing all right. I was mushing around, having a pretty good time in music video world. If you're doing a load of music videos, that's where people think you are, you know, so if you say, oh, we can do a commercial, oh, you can't possibly shoot a commercial. You wouldn't know how to sort of photograph a washing line with some soap pad. I think, what are you talking about? Of course I fucking or you can't shoot a car. And so you kind of move in these circles. And I was a lot of documentaries and things all at the same time, and worked a lot. You know, you work with a lot of, you know, want to get experience and things. And a lot of documentaries were, you know, to be made. A lot of them, you know, as they are now, totally underfinanced. So you do a lot of freebies, but you know, you're getting your, so you're working with that a lot. And then, and people weren't going to take me serious for drama. And then I got interest from someone in France, a Tunisian French man called Karim Dridi. And I went to Paris and I thought, well, at least if it's rubbish, it'll be in French, you know. Because French. So I did a couple of movies. And the second movie I did very well. It, you know, I ended up going to Cannes and did well. And the French thought they'd discovered this new cinematographer, and they gave me a Legion d'honneur, like a medal.
Wow.
I thought, well, that's very nice. My father had been a soldier. I thought, well, that was very good, getting a medal. And but then again, it didn't really break into anything in the UK. So I was sort of, you know, you get onto these plateaus, and so it's difficult to get between the two. People don't think you can shoot drama. They don't think. And of course, if you shot enough documentary, you get to know what people, you get good at guessing what people are going to do next. You also get good at knowing what shots you need to do to make a sequence. If someone's talking and there's a lot of interruptions or that things go wrong, you need editing. So you learn how to almost edit or get a wide or get a thing or get a reverse or get a scene setting view or just get them doing something interesting, like getting in and out of their car or anything to make the story flow, because you need to shorten and you need to. So I did know how to make drama, I felt. I didn't go to film school. I went on a part-time course, which was a sort of rip-off joke, but I met some other people who were sort of, you know, who also wanted to get in. I knew someone who ran on feature films. He was a runner on a feature film. That was amazing. He actually worked on feature films. But no, so I did music videos, and they kind of saved us. They pulled us up. They weren't unionized because the union were horrible. Mm-hmm. Unless you were someone's son or nephew, you weren't going to get a look in. So I worked with them, and I worked with a company called Black Audio Film Collective, John O'Confrey and stuff. And they gave me gigs. And then the other person was Derek Jarman, who was, you know, he just picked up a lot of us, you know, Waifs and Strays and Got Us Along. Seamus McGarvey was shooting for him. I never got to shoot for him. I was always, oh, you can be in it. I don't want to be in it. I want to be behind the camera. No, no, you're in it. You go over there. You cover yourself in mud. You're in war film. So I didn't get anything. Didn't get anywhere there. And then I did a film called Twin Town, which showed I could do drama with a friend of mine who I'd made a documentary in India with. And then after Twin Town, I did a film about Jean Vigo, you know, the French filmmaker with Julian Temple. And that kind of got me into, that got me noticed. And I got Plunkett McLean with my friend Jake. I'd known Jake for a while. Jake Scott, we'd made music videos together. And they kind of allowed me to shoot that. And, you know, they would have gone to a cinematographer with more experience, more drama. But then I had enough just to let me do that. And Rid saw that. He liked that. And so that put me on the map with Gladiator, and I shot Gladiator. Well, you know, I didn't really understand what size of film that would be, or I don't think anyone did. And then it just, you know, went and went and went, and became a sort of one of those films that people. I mean, I thought we'd made some nice stuff, and I remember they were doing some dubbing. I was in LA, and I was sitting with Russell, and we went to see it, and I thought, that's really good. Russell, oh, this could be better, that could be better. I thought, Russell, you just become a huge movie star. You don't realize, what do you mean this could be good? This film's perfect. Why would you have heard of me before that?
I'd like to think I keep my ear to the ground pretty well.
Well, indeed, but if you'd been watching enough music videos, you'd probably say, well, you know. And then it was about that time I decided to get away from it because I was getting a bit older and I wasn't listening to the bands anymore. Then, you know, Kurt did what he did and left us. And then, and I just thought at that stage, because then I was with Courtney and Hall and then her bass player OD'd. And I just thought, this is done. Mm. And, I just got to get into drama, but it was it's not an immediate way in. It's very difficult to get, as I say, everyone thinks, oh, he does this or he does that.
Yeah, typecast.
People think, oh, he just does massive films for Ridley and these other ones. Because I don't know how many titles I've got on the thing, but people put all sorts of stuff on your IMDb. A lot of it's not true. A lot of it's just some silly commercial or something. But there's a lot of names up there. But I mean, any people can probably name about three films I've made. But, you know, the small ones you never get to hear of. I mean, I made a film just before Gladiator for 2.1. Mm-hmm. And that's like, you know, it's good. I mean, I don't know what the final budget for Gladiator is, but it's not 1% as good as Gladiator. You know, it's a good film and but I mean, you know, they can't afford to advertise or anything. So, you know, I made a lot smaller films than have big films. That's what I'm saying, I suppose. I've done a lot smaller things. People remember the big things and they think that's what you do. You do men in sandals and leather miniskirts running around chopping each other up. Well, I've done other stuff too.
So, yes. And you know, look, I'm happy to talk to it, but in deference to our hosts here for Gladiator 2, I feel like it's important that we also, my intention for leading you down talking about the early days and Gladiator and how, at least from my outsider view, I thought maybe it's a real turning point in your career, really kind of changes, like maybe marks a change in trajectory of like, of the way your career is going. And, you know, I kind of want to, you know, take stock now because you've done all these incredible movies in between. And I'm thinking of movies like Logan. Logan is just like, you know, you've done tons of great stuff in there, but now you've done another Gladiator movie. And did it feel like getting the band back together? What was the compare and contrast? And I'd love for you to like, we don't usually talk about tech, but just because there was a 20 plus year span between here, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how tech changed from Gladiator 1 to Gladiator 2.
It has, but I mean, you know, of course, I think even to this day, most of my films I've shot on film, even the last one I just finished now was on film. There's been quite a gap between that and one before that. I mean, tech's changed, but it changed for all of us, you know. It wasn't as though I didn't do anything between 1 and 2, and Ridley's made probably more films than I have between 1 and 2. But we're all doing it incrementally. You don't really notice. Yeah, you know, I'm going to film. I'm going to shoot the nights on digital. We're going to shoot the underwater on digital. Film. We're not going to do. Actually, we're going to go full film on this because it's 3D. And then Ridley went 3D on Prometheus, and he liked the digital because he sees it. He sees good images. He sees, you know, video Siska's very poor images. So he stayed that way. I try to keep doing as much film as I possibly could. So that change was unnoticeable, let's say.
Incremental, yeah.
You know, it's just, I might not say, oh my God, that's such a huge jump. Well, you know, he'd been digital for a while. I, of course, shot a lot of digital. Can we call it video?
Sure, we can call it
video. The video, you know, they're still the same cameras, electronic cameras. They can't do red. They have problems with cyan. Where's cyan? You can't find it. Electronic cameras. So I shot more tape or documentaries on tape. I did shoot some docos on 16, but a lot of, and then some of the music videos with John Mabry. He wanted that Beta SP look. So, I mean, I was very familiar with the cameras. If you're going to make a small film, oh, I want to shoot on film. Well, guys, you know, you can, if you shoot on tape, you'll save more money for days and actors and sets because film is expensive. So, you know, there was that. Then eventually you get to shoot film. Then you move up to 35, the Grand Fromage Club, you know, shooting 35. But you see, when I came to shoot Gladiator, I was ready for that. I wasn't, so, you know, I was just, I was well within my, I wasn't daunted by it. I mean, I had very good ADs. Okay, you're doing close-ups, wide shots, whatever. It's just that these close-ups have 50 horses in the background. Other than the kitchen wall or something. It's still the same thing. It's still dealing with what's in front of you. And everybody else fills in the background for you. And people have been around cameras many years. They know what size you're on. They know how to do that. And then Ridley's on the top of you. So, you know, nothing's going to be left in the air. You know, there's not. So the jump between the two films wasn't noticeable. It is for technically, because the first film wasn't, it was 50 VFX shots total. There probably was more eventually, but 50 VFX shots. And that's why Gladiator stayed good for so long, because VFX shots from 25 years ago are not to scratch these days. But that film was very real, and I think that's one of the reasons it stayed good. I mean, it's a very good story, and it's very good, and blah, blah, blah. And all the things, you know, all the things that, why that film is so enormous is, I think, the right people at the right time, whatever. But there's a certain amount of magic happens in there, I think, that just carries, which makes some films more darling to people and more memorable. And so that jump is not, you know, it was bigger for VFX, for the costume, for special effects, for cameras. We changed our cameras, but we'd both changed our cameras before this thing came about 10 years ago. You know, we're shooting more and more digital now, less and less film. So there wasn't much in the approach to then. I mean, I don't think you get the same color integrity or fidelity out of digital cameras. I just don't think you do. But if you throw them in somewhere they don't want to go, you shoot them hard, you burn things as much as you can, you keep deep contrast, you'll get a better look. Exterior day in London, Tupperware sky, gray day in LA, they look like hell. You can't do anything with them. But, you know, if you're in a studio, you got a night or something, you know, you can make a digital camera look good. I still think film for me is better, but it's like saying, do you like coffee? Do you like tea? It's not an argument. But so different for costume, visual effects, special effects, you know, even special effects have more able stuff. You know, their technology is better. They use computers more. They design stuff in computer. They use different RAMs and hydraulics and stuff, things that weren't around then. They brought in all sorts of industrial things from robot arms that make cars into their world. Camera's still a camera. Shots are still shots.
Your film stock's gotten better. Your film stock
hasn't really changed that much. I wish it had.
They were doing at least, you know, new versions of stock up until, you know, their.
Well, maybe they have, but I mean, these are familiar.
By now they haven't changed in a long time. They haven't changed in a long time now, but there was a difference between, you know, the early 2000s. But I'm imagining digital intermediates processes improved.
They can scan better color. It's more about color, resolution. I mean, everything's more or less finished on 2K anyway, but it's the integrity of the color. You know, I think colors are really important to me. I mean, I like things dark and weird and spooky and all that stuff.
But that's where the fun is. You know, that's where the fun is. The darkness and
contrast. I think Hollywood likes me more now because since my eyes have gone and go into a digital, I switch some fucking lights on. It's dark in here. Like, I can't see anything anymore. Whereas I used to be like these murky fucking Matt Mahern, Pete Scammell music videos. Like, what can you... Nothing. But now, but I've always liked color, you know, working with Mabry, colorful artists, you know, likes up images. And this film in particular has a lot of rich color in the costume, the fabrics, you know, the mad makeup. You don't want to be all drab and desaturated. There's so much of that stuff's out there, and I'm bored of it. You know, the DPs get some nice lamps from the practical department, put some bulbs in and switch those on. It's lit. No, you haven't lit anything. You've exposed it, but you haven't actually lit anything. And that's why everything looks a bit mushy and gray and so much LED soft sources. That's why mistake things look the same. So, you know, wanted hard direct light, hard contrast, and vibrant colors. This is a colorful film. It starts a bit more muted in the beginning with the burnt deserts of Numidia, you know, just dry and none of that Lawrence Arabia golden sand juice, burnt out, white, hot. You know, everything's got dust and then Rome, colorful, opulent grapes, wine, peacock greens, paisleys, fabrics that would have come in from India and maybe from the East, silks, and all that kind of decadence. It's camp, it's vulgar, it's Vegas 1970. It's, you know, it's decadent. And so that,
let's talk about that.
Came forward, you know, and Ridley, I found, shoots maybe a bit wider than they used to. He likes to seem to have gone a bit wider. He likes lots of focus. Then it's a bit more difficult to get your long lenses in because the wide lenses push you back. But now the zooms are so good. I mean, there's a few shots in here like, that could have done with a bit more. But, you know, he likes to shoot them together. So you're reaching in with the big, powerful ingenues. They go up to 380 or something. And then you've got the wide zooms. The modern zooms are fast and they're good. They're computer designing. And zoom is very complex, all the different elements, and they will slide up and down. The focus does different things. So, and the primes, they just stayed in the box. But then the cameras are faster, you see. You get a faster ASA, so you're not... See, Gladiator 1 was shot on 50 ASA and 200. That was it. Night, day, everything. No 500, no 800, no pushing. 50 and 200. And I challenge any of the young ones out there, say, all right, let's wind this thing down. Now you light it, because you have to, because you can't see it. So that was different. But again, you know, when I chose the lenses the first time, it's all about the zooms. Because, you know, the primes are fine, and you may be a low-lit thing and say, no, we've got to shoot in prime. Sorry. But, you know, if you change a prime lens in the middle of all this action, it's out comes the matte box, out come the filters, out come the motors, off comes the thing, off comes the bridge plate, off comes the support, in goes the prime, the motors come back on, the matte box.
It's some time, yeah.
The clock takes time, but it's time that when all the energy's up, and that time feels very long and people get very impatient, and you might break the energy on the set by doing that too many times. So stick a zoom on and just take it on the chin. And if you think about it, some of the most iconic shots we know from big films are on cranes.
Mm.
Right? And what do you put on a crane? You put a zoom on.
That's right.
So you know, you do all these purists and they talk about the bouquet. Bouquet is wine. That's something you sniff. Take your bouquet and all that. Just shut up. I mean, they talk too much. There's so many lenses now. You go to a cinematographer's festival, there's just racks of black lenses in boxes. Unless you've got something really weird and funky, you're not going to notice it. So the lenses thing, it's important to catch the images. Now, Ridley, this is an epic film with a lot of detail. You want to have good, hard images with lots of focus and lots of contrast and lots of color. And don't worry, you'll get in bad situations where the color will go down, you'll be underexposed, and it will look muddy or moody, let's say. So, but I always think start where you want to be, and try and keep that stop up. You know, the contrast in the film is very high. Arthur was going to cover the sand and the same stuff he's for. I said, no, go brighter, go white. One of that dazzling white sand reflecting up into the shadow, into the shadow bleachers, hitting the faces, deep black shadows. You don't want to keep the iris open. That's too much extraneous light bouncing down the barrel of the lens. You want it to be a tight iris, go straight through, image straight onto the, and gives you more contrast, more sharpness, and more definition when you're doing close-ups. If you're doing close-up on I have to be on a longer lens because the other lenses are shooting, because the wides are shooting. So you're up on a 200, 250. If you shot it wide open at 2.8 to 8.5, 4, the background would go to mush. You want to still feel the detail that I can see by you or the shells behind you. I don't want that to be a gray, weird, black and white. You know, because you think your close-ups are running for most of the dialogue and you want them to still feel they're there. You want to see the horses moving around the background. You want to see people going, bleh. So again, for this film, it's important to, you know, people get up at 2:33 in the morning. Mm-hmm. You've got to be on your toes and fast and sharp and be ready for that. And you know, give your focus pullers a break, you know, because, you know, a horse might do something. A horse wasn't on his mark. Oh, that's surprising, you know. So at least you're giving them a better chance to catch improvisation. And I mean, if you think about it, all the lost shots in the world because the focus went.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know,
it's a horrible thing being a focus puller.
That's
why I didn't stay long as one.
Did you have a preferred stop for Gladiator 2? Did you prefer to stick around like a 5.6 or something like that?
I was deep. I was 11.16. When I was outside. Inside, you have to go with what the candles give you. I mean, I didn't light things by fire. There's always something in there. If you light it just with fire, I find it comes up too cherry red or too orange and the faces go a little bit mushy. You want a bit of some movement or color separation in there. So I use reefers and mini brutes, you know, with the 103 gel and then 187 cosmetic highlight, and that matches the flame light, but it's just a little bit more modeling, a little bit more humor in there. It's not quite so monochromatic orange. It has, so you try and supplement that. And also, if you're doing a big fire sequence, you can just get these things in low down, get them underneath the talent. So then you'd end up wider open. But I wouldn't say we'd go less than 2.8, 2.5. None of this 1.9 crap, you know. No, we're not doing that.
Yeah, I gotcha. Well, let's dive into that a little bit more then regarding just sort of the general look and philosophy. Did you feel like you wanted to have your looks sort of divided by locations or exterior interiors? Did you have a sort of overarching philosophy? There's a lot of wonderful colors. I mean,
it's not a film with a big arc in it. You know, it's two places. We start in North Africa, and they say there's a burnt desert. It's white. It's not that gorgeous sand dunes. It's scrub and dust, and they're all in some bronzes that haven't been polished. They're all sort of muddied up metal browns, leathers that have got a lot of dust into the stitching, and you know, I mean that is Morocco. It just gets everywhere. It's not a pure sand. It's like a sort of talc. It gets into everything. It gets into the cameras and the lenses, into the horse's eyes. It's, you know, always, you know, wiping horse's eyes with a cloth, you know, a damp cloth. So that had a very down, dusty, hot, overexposed look. Then you move to Rome, which is, you know, cooler streets, shaded, color, wine. You know, I see these wonderful colors that, you know, which really probably come, they're inspired from mid last centuries, from the grand tourers, the painters, pre-Raphaelite painters, totally exotic, you know, like going to Mars, you know, as far as, you know. So those painters who went there and brought back those images and people wondered at them. So those are our reference points. Jerome was the big painter that, you know, Police Verso, or the original gladiator standing over the Antibati, standing over the guy with his foot, him looking up at the roll box, and they're all like this, and they've got, you know, it's some weird reason there's lots of tapestries hanging off the side, and people are drunk and drinking through beautiful Venetian glasses, and they go, so that is, you know, that painter is the one that we go back to, the assassination of Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a little bit of it in Napoleon as well, that kind of light that Darick and Ridd did on that as well. So going with that, so when we go to Rome, it's colorful, it's brighter, it's more up, it's more almost front lit. And then the sort of treachery stuff that happens underground, that's at night, candlelight, obscure, down in the caves when they're trying to, the plotters. And then there's more intimate scene, so that I use more yellow colors, the more intimate scenes with Acacius and Lucilla, so with Pedro and Connie, they're warmer, they're more romantic, more orange. than the more lemon yellow treacherous ones. And then what happens in the palace? The palace is a bit weird. Shot it day for night. I wish we could have blocked it all off, but it's got this very odd tones to it, which I didn't really think would end up like that, but I like it.
Mm.
It's mm-hmm. what we could do. So it's not, but the rest is not much for color arc, you see. So it's, you know, really that, the Rome shaded, you know, and then the brightness of the Colosseum.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a juxtaposition between what's going on inside the arena and what's going on outside the arena, though, for sure. And it feels like there's a, you know, and it's not just that it's harsh and brutalistic, but it's like there's, I mean, yeah, there's something about the way what's happening during these Colosseum battles, the fights and the, you know, the life or death struggle that's happening there versus the subterfuge and the treachery and all the sort of the political drama and infighting that's happening outside. Was there a thought process of
The sand, I say, for the original one was quite sandy color. I said to Arthur, go white, go brighter. So what happens is you hit the arena, which isn't actually that big. With, you know, we were there at the wrong time of year, to be honest. We were there too early. And so the midday sun comes screaming down on that. It goes super white. The shadows go black. And the light bounces into the bowl of the arena. And that bowl, then you get that sort of, it's theater. Yeah. It's like going to the opera, and they get the glow off the stage of all the audience. They're getting this light that comes out and catches the first 15, 20 rows, and it just dies away. You know, so you up in the gods. So it's shadowed by the Valerium, which was something I built the first one. Then Arthur took it over. This one used these huge strips of canvas that came out and shadowed the audience. Because, you know, if you just shot it with bright sun, it would have been like a sort of soccer match. You know, the background would be too busy. So when you see, you know, Lucius out there fighting a rhino or whatever, you feel they're really the bright searing heat on this white tablecloth. And then in the background, it's darker. So you get a contrast. You know, if it had light falling on them, it'd be all very busy, like watching a sports match and the guys, the ball goes, you want to, so it's like theater.
Contrast, opera. Yeah.
So, you know, so yes, there is a difference. So I was overexposing more or getting the curve higher up. So it was almost peaking on that white.
Okay.
Sliding the back end down to increase that contrast. Going into the parties and the houses, that was a bit softer, and all the fabrics, and they're eating a snorting rhino horn, which makes your eyes water. And sometimes.
So they say.
That's what I heard about. And so they're snorting rhino horn and they're eating peacocks and stuff like that. So that's more bacchanalian, vulgar, decadent. So that's a different look. Bright and up, not burnt like that. You know, it feels like a nice room to be in. It feels like breezy and light and
for sure. Let me ask you about working with the CG. You know, it's you've done a ton of your, you know, the movies that you've done, entire characters, entire, you know, locations, all kinds of stuff. I get various different reactions from people. It's a necessity for modern tent poles and blockbusters. But I've also heard from DPs who will remain nameless that they die a little bit inside every time they say, okay, now it's time for the VFX and now it's time for the plate. How do you feel about the integration of CG into what it is that you're doing?
I think it was necessary. I mean, you know, really love CG, you know, because the first one was, it was, you know, special, hadn't really done much. You know, his old style was plates. His big sort of CG films to then, or what you equate to it would have been Blade Runner with Mitchell cameras, motion control.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
map tanks. Leave them going overnight. And he said he'd rush in the morning because it was somewhere down here on the coast. And the first thing they do is they go to the seismograph or whatever you call it on the wall to see if there are any spikes in the night, if there are any tremors.
That's right. Yeah.
Screwed the shot. Like, ah, okay. Oh, and there was a tremor. Oh, shit. Oh, we'll try it again tonight. So that was very painstaking. And of course, he'd used it a little bit on films, but he was suspicious. I mean, he kept building. Arthur didn't understand. He kept building. He, you know, Colosseum went to past 60 feet. I said, stop building. I can't get any cranes over the top. So, yeah. But this time, you know, he's been, you know, I guess from Prometheus, 3D films, all that stuff. He's in there and he's swimming around in it and loves it. I mean, look at Napoleon. I mean, he knows exactly, you know, he's painting with it now, making these enormous landscapes. So But you know, he's a great draftsman, he's got a great eye, so I've got no fear about him doing CG. So, but it was absolutely going to be necessary, and it is wherever you look these days. So it is a much bigger part of things. I suppose, you know, we could have got real rhinos. It would take forever. Real boats on the sea would still be there.
Yeah, of course.
So, but I think the level and the finish level and the excellence he wants from it are great. I mean, I love the sea battle in the Colosseum with the mini boats and all the costume. I think that's a great coordination between obviously Ridley in charge, the visual effects, the special effects, bringing that together with the dry shoot initially, then adding the water in the tank, making the Colosseum go up the road, rebuild the Colosseum in the tank, not all of it, but you know, and then have the water bound stuff, people falling in, smashing boats together, splinters, sinking, sharks, all that stuff. So that's a great sequence, I think, even though from my end, I didn't have to do much, you know, just, you know, of course you have to know where one takes over and that, this, that, and the other. And you understand it because, you know, the water's flat. You know the way the water is. So you know, if you're running around underneath the water, you can put a camera you like. If you stick your head up, you better look like a Loch Ness monster or something, or some a shark's nose. So you, you know, we didn't have too many previs things, but I mean, I think it's quite evident. I mean, everyone's been around it long enough to understand. And of course, we're not making monsters here. We're not making great big characters. These are real people. We're supplementing things. We're adding more of the same thing. There are, I suppose the monkey fight is, the baboon fight is the total CG thing. But even then, they fought with stunt
performers, yeah, some
smaller guys to actually fight. Because, you know, you're actually going to, you need someone to fight. And, you know, it's great for us as operators or whatever, because they can really see them. But if I'm going to hit you on a plate, that's not going to work. I need to see that stop, sure, that physicality, yeah, that dust. You see, punch someone, you see the shock waves go back through the shoulder. So we really shot. That was great. It's great. We knew, you know, you could loosen up the camera, do what you wanted. They're really throwing each other around. Oh, he went over there. Oh, he went over there. So if you shot that traditionally with a plate, someone stands in the middle, nothing moves. A little bit of that in the first Gladiator with a split screen. You just, your language has moved on. It wouldn't be acceptable. So VFX is very much, and I don't,
it's the name of the game these days.
I don't mourn that. I mean, what else are we going to do on this film? I mean, how else are we going to get it done? I mean, but do it well.
That's right.
And Mark was very thankful to do as much as you can with the visual effects, with real extras, with real buildings. And then at least you have something to cut with. You know, it's very difficult to go to the cutting room with half the shots missing because they waited for the monster to be. So, you know, it's a real act. So you know, out the energy, you know, if a scene works even before they've added those elements.
What gets you excited? What gets you excited when you get a script, when something, a project comes to you, what makes you think, I want to take this job? What is it that, what do you look for in a project?
You hopefully you like the script, which
is there particular aspects you look for? Is there like a bucket list of things that you want to work on, or is it the people, or is it like the subject matter?
You could say that. I mean, most of the films I like, or almost the directors, they've been made, or they're working with a great DP. So, I mean, I wish I'd done that. So you hopefully like the script, you like the director, or one of those two things, but both of them is. That means you're going to be away, and also knowing that the director doesn't turn into some sort of monster as soon as you hit the first slate. You look for the the script and the director, and you meet and talk and see if they want to employ you or not. I mean, everyone thinks you get a choice. I mean, I wish I did have more choices, but I mean, you get thought of as the sword and sandals guy, which I never thought I'd be the sword and sandals guy. I was doing grunge videos. That was me. That was so there's not a lot of requirements for that in the drama. But anyway, so, you know, those two things, You know, I try to avoid biopics. I think they're kind of, you know, when everyone makes one, they're always a bit, I don't know, I mean, a lot of music ones recently, which are all terrible, I think. Because if you remember the musician and there's lots of footage, I mean, then you're not going to, no one's ever going to, if there's too much stuff about someone, when it's been 50 years or something, the Elvis film I thought was very successful. I like to think I can do anything. You know, I did come from documentaries. I don't want to light everything perfectly and do all this of streaming sunlight and the orange fires. And, you know, I like to think I don't have a style, you know, that I can do, adapt to what is on the page or what is important. Rather than, you know, now's the time for photography. Now is not the time for photography. Now is the time to get the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and do shots that aren't, you know, of course you want to do fancy shots. I always look for transitions in the script. How do we get from this scene to that scene to that scene? And I always write down transition. Now, you know, about 80% of those transition ideas never see the light of day, but I talk to the director about them. And then, of course, they shift the scenes around so it comes in. Anyway. But you want to... know, you've got to know where you are in the movie when you're going to do a big shot or demand that, you know, sometimes you demand, I'd say, I don't understand where I am. We need to open this film up. We need some big city shots. We need a transition from day to night. We need a big crane shot, the director said. I said, in the big crane shot in the middle of the sequence, you know, that's happening over there. You're intercutting with this. We don't have time for a crane shot. You'll use it, but you'll cut as soon as that crane lands on the actor. So we spent 3 hours getting an arm up in the air and you won't be using it. So I'm very aware of the editing. I did work in cutting rooms. It's all very well doing fancy shots, but you've got to make sure they are timed. You know, if it's not character or script and it's not doing anything, that's just a fancy shot, there's a chance it's going to end up on the floor because all our films are too long. You know, small scenes become big scenes become small scenes. You never really know. You know, the final draft of the script is the edit. It's not what you shoot. It's not what you have in the paycheck. You know, you get to the thing, wow, that's different. I did start in cutting rooms, like rubber numbering, which is a way of time coding magnetic stripe. And so I did see a lot of big shots, just cutting room floor, never make it. But I still made the same mistake, did those big shots and saw my own shots, cutting room floor, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. So, yeah, look for transitions, read the script, break down the characters, what do they do, how do they walk into the scene, how do we get from this to this to this, and try and be really economic, and then sort of maybe even time it yourself. And then I'm always going to the script supervisor, how long are we running, how long, and when you're shooting, how long are we running now? And if you're like, you know, 2 weeks in and you're 6 minutes over, that's a problem, because you know what's going to go is the photography.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
John, this has been a delight. I'm so glad that we had a chance to chat about the movie and about your career. This is terrific. Is there a place online? Do you do the social medias? Do you do an Instagram or anything like that?
I've got one.
Follow you, but yeah,
I don't really look at it. I don't really do that. My daughter put me on it and it's just pictures of me and chickens and horses, I'm afraid.
All right. Well,
I might start doing it now because there's a lot of pressure and, but I've got an account, but I can't even remember how to open it.
I figured I would ask as part of our wrap up here. I just wanted to see if there was a place, but of course they can go watch all your incredible body of work on streaming services. You know, Gladiator 2 is out now. Go see Gladiator 2. John Matheson, thank you so much for being on the Cinematography Podcast.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Take care. All right. So that was John Matheson. John, thank you so much for being on the show. It was great chatting with you. And Gladiator 2, congratulations. What a massive hit.
Amazing work. Love it.
Hey, Ben, you know what time it is.
I do. I think it's time to pay the bills.
It is time to pay the bills. We got to thank our...
trying to steal your thunder there, sorry.
You stole it. It's stolen. Hey, we got to thank our fine friends over at Arri, makers of all kinds of incredible cameras and lenses. And of course... lights. And in fact, I want to talk about lights today because there is a story up in the Arri blog over at Arri.com. We'll put a link to it over at Cam Noir so you can get to it easily. But it is all about Karate Combat. Okay, they also use the Orbiter, which is another more point source LED light that Arri makes, for this Karate Combat. And Karate Combat, it's worth going and looking at this blog and checking it out, because it's a hybrid combination. First of all, they don't use a traditional ring or a cage. They use sort of this like big open space with these slanted borders, which means that, you know, frankly, the fight can extend onto these other surfaces, and the audience is right there. There's no separation really between the audience and what's going on in the ring, which is kind of crazy. Maybe there's a separation of 5 or 6 feet or something like that, but there isn't like a physical barrier or of any sort, like the cage or like, so that means the cameras can be shooting, you know, unobstructed down at eye level, but of course they have cranes and all kinds of other stuff. And then they worked in this sort of green screen virtual stage sort of environment, which only the people who are watching it like via YouTube or on television get to see. So it looks like the crowd that's there is sort of in this like fantastical place. And they have this, virtual sort of like marquee, which is giving you information and ads that sort of like floating above them. So it really is this combination of like what's real and what's not real. And also, I gotta say, and this is where the Arri comes in, the Arri products come in particular, it's not the high key sort of lighting that you associate with most boxing or mixed martial arts. They definitely have some style with this. There's like, it's a little bit more low key. It's like, it's a really interesting look, but anyway, really cool, very interesting stuff. Arri looks like they were deeply involved in how this all went together. There's a behind the scenes time lapse of them like building the arena, and I highly recommend checking it out. So Arri, of course, always doing cool stuff. Definitely worth taking a look at this. You can find the link over at our website or at Arri.com. Thanks, nice. Arri.
And now, short ends.
All right, so Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's the time when we talk about our pet obsessions of the week. Is there something that you are obsessed about and you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little slightly aggrieved about something, and and it's AI related. And so I would encourage people to check out an article from The Ankler by Elaine Lowe called TV Writers Found 139,000 of Their Scripts Trained AI, All Hell Broke Loose. But this to me is a for real scandal. And unfortunately, it's on The Atlantic behind a paywall. Not this article on the Ankler, but there's a thing where you can search to see if your script, The Atlantic did a thing where you could search to see if your script was one of the ones. But they're talking about Shonda Rhimes, 508 scripts credited to her, 346 from Ryan Murphy, 742 episodes of Futurama and The Simpsons, stuff like Twin Peaks, which I think is hilarious. AI, I'd like to see AI try and make Twin Peaks. Good luck with that, AI. And here's how they were doing it. Like, basically, the agreements kind of prohibited scripts from being fed in, but these various AI systems were able to scrape subtitles. So they're able to pull in every line of dialogue off of the subtitles of all of these shows. And
the closed captioning was the undoing.
Yeah. Wow. And I mean, it's pretty obnoxious. And, you know, anyone who listens to the podcast knows I'm not against AI. I'm not anti-AI. I think AI is really cool in certain ways. And, you know, we went out of our way to bring Michael Cioni, who created one of the coolest AI post-production workflows I've ever seen, Strata, on here. I think AI is a great tool and will be used in the future to do a lot of the grunt work that, you know, in every department. I think if a writer is writing their outline and they choose to use ChatGPT to help ideate whatever they're going to put in their outline, you know, go with God. It's none of my business any more than whether you use spell check or whether you manually check all your spelling. But the fact that this is like a clear effort to to train models to write scripts and to write dialogue. And, you know, the thing is, could an AI bot, you know, write Aaron Sorkin-esque dialogue? Probably. And monologues? Sure. But it kind of gets to, you know, for me, like the whole reason that we go to movies, television, plays, art, music, whatever, you know, because like there's AI music that sounds really good right now. But like, It's not just that it's soulless. It's that, like, what are you going to this? What do you go to the stuff you love for? Is it just that you want to see a story, or you want pretty colors and pretty pictures, or are you wanting to, like, be on the receiving end of a communication by an artist, which to me is the reason that you would read a novel, or, you know, or produce a screenplay, or have, you know, bring actors out to work on a thing. And so, like, the less human, like, the initial creation of it is, to me, like, I'm just not interested. I don't know who's going to be interested in watching a sitcom that's written by a robot.
I'm going to go to a slightly unconventional and controversial place right here, Ben. Just as a warning for our more sensitive listeners. You've probably heard about the idea that all new technologies are adopted by porn before they're adopted by the mainstream.
Yeah.
I am not an expert in this, but I do not think that porn is going to be totally usurped by AI. Mm-hmm. I just don't see that. I don't think that that is really a thing. So it makes it really, really hard for me to believe that if porn is not going to be usurped, and, like, they knew that Blu-ray was going to be a thing because porn was into Blu-ray before it was ever, like, VHS, a thing for the mainstream.
I mean, it's like
VHS, exactly.
Virtually every streaming video, every technology.
Every technology was, it was at one time porn first. I know that there are people who are doing, like, deepfakes and they're doing stuff like that. But
I mean, that's using AI.
Yeah, but that is not... Yeah, I don't think that is generating, you know, hey, I'm the pizza delivery guy, or I'm the plumber, and, you know, showing up here to the showing up to the home, and then, you know, it's creating the script and creating the characters and creating everything else. I believe that AI will certainly get used for animation, and I don't think that animation porn is particularly popular. It might be a subgenre out there, but
perhaps I will say
it could be all kinds of things. But what is interesting to me is that there is an endless supply of free pornography that could be training AIs right now, and that does not seem, at least as far as I can tell, does not seem to be a thing. It also makes me think that the uncanny valley and having a genuine human connection and interaction is such a bridge too far that when I see a lot of the stuff that's generated with AI right now, it feels like a video game cutscene. And correct me if I'm wrong, but there's not too many people out there who want to pay money or spend their time watching just video game cutscenes to have a, you know, an emotional experience. Because let me tell you, you could do that right now. You could absolutely have video game cutscene movies that, you know, the whole thing is animated in that way. And it's just not a very good experience. I mean, look, I would expect Pixar to go AI, you know, at some point, or to use some sort of AI, but I don't really see it.
Well,
transition
I think
changing.
It's academic that AI makes its way into a Pixar workflow. And I,
for sure,
I love your canary in the porn mine example, because I think that's actually interesting to say, because, like, that's maybe one of the places where people are like, they want authenticity above everything else. And, you know, like, when I agree about the cutscene thing, and I think that a lot of people are like, this is just in its infancy. It's just going to keep getting better. And I'm like, is it going to get, like, as much better in the next 3 years as it has in the past 3 years? Or is it going to get better, like, over the next, is it going to take 20 years to get that much better? You know, because I don't, I think that, like, right now it's an awesome parlor trick. It's also an amazing tool. I was watching a tutorial about Runway ML's new thing where you can expand a frame in video. And so, like, let's say you had a close-up shot of somebody and you wanted to make it into a wide shot. You could do it. That's cool. You know, but it starts with, you wrote a script. There's a script there. There's an actor there. They're performing. There's a genuine thing there. And now I'm adding more trees on the left and the right side of the frame, or more cityscape, or more crowd, or whatever. Like, the parts that aren't the part where the
important
emotional center of it is.
Yeah, I think you're dead on there, the Ben. And look, there's other technologies that people proselytize is going to be the next big thing. And I'm thinking about, like, virtual reality and 3D, where they said, oh, just wait, it's going to be so great in a few years. And you know what? the audience is rejected.
Yeah,
the audience
rejected video. Everyone was all excited about 360 there was a, video.
Oh my God, 360 video was going to be the thing.
Yeah, and, I even made a thing in 360 video and I'm like, I don't enjoy making things in 360 video. It's no fun.
You're not the only one. And it's like, there are technologies that come forth. They get an awful lot of heat. They get an awful lot of attention. And I firmly believe that the AI that people are talking about, which is going to take everyone's jobs and is going to usurp Hollywood.
It's going to take jobs. I have no doubt. Well, some jobs are going away.
Not everyone's job. Certainly not everyone's job. And I will say that the people who are proselytizing it, it's the same thing as these other technologies we've seen that did not happen.
Well, it's a bubble. It's a gold rush. And, you know, I'd say, you know, for NVIDIA, who now I think is evaluated at higher than Apple, because they're the main hardware people use to generate AI. Like, you know, I don't quite understand the GPU technology of it, but I know that NVIDIA is the choice of all these AI, even ChatGPT, even just large language models are using it. You know, cool. You can't unring the bell. It's going to be there forever. I mean, like, for God's sakes, I think it was Microsoft recently bought 3 Mile Island. Great PR on that, by the way, so that they could generate enough power for their upcoming AI. Good work, Microsoft.
Amazon is putting in 4 micro nuclear power plants in Washington State, right off the Columbia River, specifically for their increasing needs on AI. They say.
It's going to be a big deal. It already is a big deal. But yeah, this to me is a bridge too far. And also, I may have to eat these words later after they are scraped off the internet and a robot puts it into a fake version of myself to say out loud. But no matter how many episodes of The Simpsons you scrape, you're not going to be able to train an AI to write an even okay episode of The Simpsons. You might get one that could outline what would happen in an episode of The Simpsons, but it's not going to write funny jokes.
It'll be very interesting to watch what happens, and certainly the timeline in which everyone continues to say, because look, we're in the infancy, but the more years that go by and it doesn't happen, the more I think my point is
proven. I think we're in the toddlerhood where it's like you're exhausted about hearing about it, and it poops a lot.
That's pretty accurate.
And you have to clean it up.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of cleanup going on right now.
All right, so Ilya, what is your short end?
Well, this episode is dropping right before Black Friday, and Black Friday is a really interesting time of year. It's a time, you know, look, actually, I've been writing a little blog about this, and when I finish it, you know, I'll mention it on the podcast in case anyone wants to read, but it's sort of a, you don't know Black Friday. You don't really know what Black Friday is. Now, and I'll ask you, Ben, do you know where the term Black Friday comes from? Do you know?
Isn't it really because this is when these companies get into the black?
That's true, but it actually didn't start that way. It originally started with the Philadelphia Police Department, because the Philadelphia Police Department realized that the day after Thanksgiving was the worst day to work. They were like, there's more people out, there's more traffic, there's more problems, there's more things going on the day after Thanksgiving. So inside the police department, they called it Black Friday. Now, retailers eventually claimed that back. They claimed it back.
They took back the night on that one.
They took back the term Black Friday. But in addition to that, it is a time when most people who are at least in any sort of like business to consumer or retail environment offer discounts to try to encourage sales. And this is self-serving. Hot Rod Cameras is also doing that. I wish that people understood Black Friday a little bit better, because Black Friday isn't so much better than buying it almost any other time of year if you know how to shop. But most people do not know how to shop, so they rely on like, oh, there's a thing, I'm going to add it to my cart and try to get my discount right now. The reality is that every sort of scientific study that basically goes out and compares Black Friday sales versus sales any other time of the year, they don't always actually measure up as the deepest discount. Hot Rod Cameras is doing a big Black Friday sale. I'm going to publish this blog. I don't know exactly where yet. It's truly against my own interest, because the way every online e-commerce brand is out there, and us included, is you want people to just go to a product, add it to cart, and then check out. That is the least amount of human interaction, that costs the business the least amount of money to make a sale, and it's less advantageous to the customer. So We actually have a thing on our website. It's not exactly hidden. It's very obvious, but most people don't use it. And it's called add to quote instead of add to cart. If you add items to the quote, it then goes to a human being who looks at it. And if you put it in the comments like, hey, I'm looking to save some money, or do you have an alternative to this product? Or, you know, I don't really need this right away. Is there possible I can save some money if we order it in? Yada, yada, yada. There are ways to save beyond that is even what's listed in the cart. In fact, if you add items to cart, you don't get the benefit of having a human look at the add to quote. And if you add to quote, you have the ability to possibly get a better price. And the number one way that people should be trying to get a better price, especially if you're willing to pay cash, pay by ACH or wire transfer, any sort of B2B out there understands that there is a 2% cost every time someone uses a credit card. You can save 2% if you just don't pay by a credit card. And there's lots of ways to do that if you're willing to have a human interaction with someone, if you're willing to talk to someone about...
That's a big ask, man, talking to people. Have you met people?
If you're spending $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, 2% goes a long way. For an individual, you can save more money, you have a human interaction, you talk to someone. My shop, Hot Rod Cameras, is all about the human interaction. It's all about having a conversation. And saving people money is actually part of what we do. So even though it's against my own interest to tell people, hey, don't necessarily shop just by clicking and buying, have a, you know, submit to a quote, you might be able to save a couple of bucks. I would rather do that because I'd rather have people come back to us and work with us for the long term rather than just be transactional, like make a transaction and move on. Better to have that conversation, better to have a relationship, better to get better service and know who it is that you're shopping from. So I guess my short end this week is Black Friday. There you go. And the sale that's going on at Hot Rod Cameras. It's a long-winded way for me to get there.
Wow. Yeah, that is. All right. That's a lot.
So, Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you? They want to find you.
Well, you can find me at benrock.com. You can learn all you ever wanted to know about me, but also, like, increasingly, go to Blue Sky. I'm loving Blue Sky, and it's becoming a lot like the Twitter of old, where it's not full of toxic, weird stuff. It's not full of an algorithm that's forcing any political anything on you. It's like, if you want to talk movies with people, you can talk movies with people there, and it seems pretty low on the troll factor, which, you know, like Twitter, I'm not completely off of Twitter, but like the troll factor on Twitter makes it really hard to stay engaged. So Ilya, where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Hit us up for any sort of cameras, lightings, lenses, post-production equipment, hard drives, all those sorts of needs.
Do you have lens cloths?
We usually give them away for free. But yes, we do have some lens tissue for the people who want to buy that, and Pangro cleaners and all that kind of jazz too.
Good, good. Just wanted to make sure. Right.
Yeah, we got it. We got that. There's even some lens.
Do you have those lens pens that used to be very popular?
So Ben, who do we have to thank this episode? Who made this show possible?
Oh man, our long-suffering editor, Michael Dispenza, and due to a couple of technical issues, he had some suturing to do. So thank you, Michael. Always appreciate all your hard work. We got to thank Alana Cody, who is setting up all these amazing interviews and more to come, like the aforementioned Alice Brooks. Usually I don't talk about who we have coming up, but like I feel like
highly relevant today, though. Highly relevant. Yeah, for sure.
And Alice is awesome, and she's been on the show before, and I feel like today, you know, this weekend we might have two of our major contenders for best cinematography at the Oscars. So I'm excited every time we talk to someone who I feel like is going to be is probably on a glide path to certain nomination or other awards this season, BAFTAs and ASC awards, et cetera, et cetera. And then last but never least, we got to thank Kays Alatrakshi, who composed all the music you heard in the episode. Check out his website, musicbykays.com. Hire him, for God's sakes. I actually went to see Gladiator 2 with Kays.
Okay. What did he think of the music?
He actually had thoughts about the music because, like, Hans Zimmer did the original score, and even though they referenced the Hans Zimmer score, he could articulate this better than me. But even though they referenced the Hans Zimmer score, he could tell it wasn't Hans Zimmer, or if it was Hans Zimmer, it wasn't whoever at the Hans Zimmer corporate headquarters was doing the Gladiator theme back in 2000.
That's a very astute ear. Yeah, I would not have known that. So, all right. So Ben, that just about does it for us. You want to take us out?
Man, you're making me do all that stuff. Yeah, thanks for tuning in.
You want to do it together?
Sure, let's do it. One, two,
three. Thanks for tuning in. Okay, on three. It's one, two, three, then you go.
Okay ready? Great. One, okay. Two, three.
Thanks for tuning in.
What the fuck, dude? That's all I'm doing. I'm not doing it again.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.